money next to him, and we got that money too, and that also was very popular. What was that? That's like in Pennsylvania. Just at the time, that was probably 1967 or 68. One question before we end that
time. I visited West Texas Planet, the other planet at that time.
Roll time thing?
Yes, sir.
Did that, maybe if I can tell us about the time you flew the plane out of West Texas, if there's anything else to say about it.
There were tremendous storms out there, and we had trouble with lightning storms knocking our power down.
We were tied in to the local power plant. We floated on them, so when we generated excess power, it went to them. And one night, there were, I think, 20 power failures. And every time, this whole plant would go crashing. And we would be out there relighting all this. And now the hydrogen and thorium are running around, and the cells don't pick up. And during one of these, we made some little loop. And the hydrogen and thorium went back. I remember watching those cells. They looked like ice cream cones. They just, all of them went up in the air. Like, nobody was hurt, but they ruined a lot of equipment. And we put that together.
This was Kennedy's invention, he said, his process.
Yes.
So he held the patents on it, or it were their patents? Was it just, did he just keep it as proprietary information?
I do not know whether there were any patents on that first process or not.
At that time, or at Shell, did you get involved in any patenting activity?
When I was at Shell, because of an accident, I took some samples in a butane isomerization plant because the product looked peculiar, and I found that we had made some neohexane, which at that time, no one really knew how to make. And so I went back to the laboratory, and we did some laboratory work, and we found that with the catalyst we were using for the butane isomerization became sludge, we could make neohexane. And Shell decided they wanted to investigate that process at Emeryville. I wrote all this up. And after I got working for Frontier Chemical, I was reading one day, and there is the patent. Exactly as my notes were written up without my name on it. And I wrote back a few nasty letters, but I didn't get answers from them. I realized I would have to sue. There's nothing to sue for. Unless they build a plant, it's going to be very hard. All I'm going to do is default that.
Yeah.
I was a little irritated over this, just because they put some people's name on it who obviously had nothing to do with it. I don't know who they were.
Well, that would have irritated me too. It's understandable. Speaking of Emeryville, you said a little while ago that looking ahead while you were still at Shell, you didn't see opportunity for movement other than up the ranks at that particular refinery. Was there much movement to, say, the development company out in California, or you were?
It was very difficult to move from the operating company, Shell Oil, and Shell Development. I did that. They were two almost separate companies. And although I worked for Shell Research when I worked at Houston, peculiarly that was there, that was part of Shell Development. I was just on the road there. And I didn't think that this was even a possibility. I'm not sure I knew enough about whether I would be comfortable with a bachelor's degree in an organization, research organization. When I informed Shell that I was going to leave, and gave them, I've got 30 days or 60 days notice, they immediately wanted to know why I was leaving and all this, and they thought it impossible to leave that I wasn't put off with something there, which I wasn't specifically. And they immediately offered if I wanted to go to their New York office or if I wanted to go to Emeryville or something, they would be glad to do this. I had made an ethical commitment. I would not have possibly backed down, but I often wondered if I had gone in and said I was unhappy and didn't forget whether they would have made that offer or not. I assume they would have. I just hadn't recognized them. Levers that perhaps I had at the time, but I don't regret about that. I didn't think twice.
Did Shell take a promising young man and give them
an advanced education so that in time you could have had a chance to create the estate of Shell? No. We asked. I did take one course at Washington University, or started one, when I was working at Shell, but I nearly got shipped to the ship to work, and I couldn't go anymore, so I had to drop out in the middle of the course. So all I got to know is some of the people over there. But they did not encourage this. They would have sort of said, if you have time left over, we'll find something for you to do. That's probably not a current attitude.
But at that time, it was. So, just to shift back then, you decided after the sellout that there was a similar, you're just feeling restless, maybe wrong to put it, but you felt that maybe you did want to go back to Michigan after all. And was there any thought of going somewhere else, or have you maintained contact with the faculty in Michigan?
I have not maintained much contact. I have seen some of the people that CAG meetings, Katz and others, and I had talked to Katz in maybe 1945, AICG meeting in St. Louis, to check a date about the possibility of coming back to graduate work, and he said, if you are interested, why don't you write to me? When I decided to go back to graduate work, which was maybe 6 months, because I was aware maybe 6 months before it would sell out, it was likely possible, I wrote to Katz. I also wrote to Five Up. I was that time torn between whether I wanted to go back to chemical engineering or mathematics. I actually had perhaps more advanced preparation in mathematics.
Feiglov said it would be foolish to do this in mathematics, that
in anything the 5 years' experience you have will be looked at as a negative factor with mathematicians, and it's an invaluable asset in chemical engineering. So that's what I did.
And you returned to Michigan in 47?
Yes,
47. Now, what are other reasons why you returned, why you went to graduate school? You became a disenchantment with the lifestyle of a person who advanced perhaps at Shell.
Well, I also was rescued, but I think both at Shell Frontier, I became interested in things, and I never would get to complete them. Mm-hmm.
That is, I would think something is very interesting, we could really improve that, but you know, the urgency of operation is always, if something's working, leave it alone and go do something else. And so I thought I would rather do research for teaching. Mm-hmm. I think that was really the motivation. See, when I thought about mathematics, I was thinking that only for acts of teaching.
Was a strong attraction at the time to become an educator rather than industrial chemist?
I don't think I would make a decision whether I would go back to where I would do research in industry or teach when I went back to graduate school. I think I was hoping maybe about thinking about teaching, but I was not well enough acquainted with what teaching about, what job opportunities might be.
Of course, there were merchant opportunities in the chemical industry at that time.
Yes,
was that part of the calculus that you were applying, if you will, thinking that if you went back on a PhD, you'd be a much better position?
I served at Shell. I almost had a feeling if I came back to Shell with this, then I would have much better position doing the same kind of things that I was doing with a lot more flexibility.
So I think I had confidence that with a PhD I could get a job and a better one.
When you returned, it was 47, you got your MSc. 48?
Yes.
Okay, and you became a research assistant.
While
you
were
in your MSc or MD?
Now I'm trying to think when I started. That may have been after 1 year. I just used my savings to go to graduate school the first year, and took all coursework and completed the PhD, completed the master's degree that year.
Have you found that the department had changed over the 4 years? Was it different personnel? Was the atmosphere different?
Well, it was probably a 50% turnover, but I knew almost everyone there. They either were graduate students who were around when I was a graduate student or a former faculty. So R.R. White, whom I worked more closely than anyone else, was new. And Joe Martin came that same year and was new. And Robert Williams had come in the meantime and was new, although he may have overlapped with me. And but of course Brown and Katz were still there, and Breyer was back, and Faust was back, and so I knew almost everybody. They didn't know me particularly, these were, but I felt quite familiar.
How this is also a time when by now I suppose that this would be a good time to start talking about the impact of applied mathematics on chemical engineering around that period. It was, by then there had been Sherwood and Reed at 37, Marshall and Pinker's text came out in 47. The MIT and Minnesota had begun giving courses on applied math, and in fact in 48 Michigan introduced one that Martin taught us.
I took that.
Oh, so you took that the first the first time as well?
We used Sherwood and Reed and Marshall and Pickford, of course.
Yeah. Was there must have been a sense that something was happening in chemical engineering with all of this going on.
I was just absolutely stunned at the change in chemical engineering that had taken place in 4 years. If I had had any sense at all, I would have gone back and done a year of undergraduate work instead of going directly onward, because the curriculum had changed just overwhelmingly in that 5 years.
In what ways? Well, they were teaching thermodynamics now, they were teaching reaction engineering, they were teaching applied mathematics. They had written the unit operations text in
this was a great step forward in that venue, and so
every course was perhaps unrecognizable in my time.
Really, yes. Do you think that had anything to do with the warriors and the problems of scale and various kinds of enterprise, well, like the enterprise you've engaged in with the chemical cracking? Had the faculty initiative had similar experiences that led them to reconceptualize the way they wanted to teach?
I think it was a transition of a generation of people. And I think that Katz and Faust and Brown, who are the, in a sense, older school, but not that old, were receptive to this. Mm-hmm. And so the younger generation of PhDs who had studied a lot of mathematics and engineering science and things, York and Brownell and Banchero and Slesovich, and these people brought in all that new material. And then these textbooks were written, the Bobby Trail Hobby Watson was the first book on chemical reaction engineering, the Martian Big Bird's book, and these were all. Did you find that the biomechanics was part of the missionary six graduate school program chemical engineering to do that? Did you find that there was a nice fit between what was being taught and
that it fit nicely into chemical engineering problems? So was there an awkwardness initially?
Well, Joe Martin was one of the great all-time teachers, and so I never felt any awkwardness in how he was doing. But of course, I was over-prepared for that course. This may have been a great stroke of luck. When I came back, I had so much more mathematics than any other student in that class, but it was instant rapport. So I was sort of developing that course with Martin. That was a great lucky thing.
You know, how many students were in it?
When I went back to graduate school that year, there may have been 200 graduate students at the University of Michigan, maybe 300.
Really?
There were classes for 100 there. So I probably would have been psyched out in advance if I had known this. The GI Bill had returned. So what they were collecting were 5 years of people plus money for the first time to go to graduate school, and all these people feeling they needed retreading in order to go to industry. And so there was a tremendous number of people floating around, and I felt at first totally up with it. My experience saved me in heat transfer courses and things like this, and distillation. I had all those 5 years of experience, and it helped a lot. In the mathematics course, I had a lot of help. And I needed to constantly took more math courses, so I was doing the equivalent of a master's degree in mathematics at the same time. I was very rusty in those things. But thermodynamics, I had to take a graduate course in thermodynamics before I took the undergraduate course. It was a traumatic experience. So the next semester, I went back and studied, took the undergraduate course, or self-studied it with all the problems all semester, because I realized I would have to pass the doctoral exam on that undergraduate material. And I was reading their undergraduate unit operations notes, all of which was totally new to me, which we weren't covering. But I felt that if I didn't do all that backup work, I would never catch up with it.
What kind of mathematics was used in the applied math course? What were you being taught to apply?
I would say Marshall and Pickford and Sherwin-Reed are typical of the types of things we were doing. We were solving problems in convection and in conduction and distillation and in statistics and all things using Fourier series and Laplace transform and
those kind of things. What is now maybe classical advanced mathematics, maybe
our undergraduate study now. They take an advanced course.
What was the text in the thermo courses you were taking? Any other courses you took your first year of graduate school, in addition to the applied math texts? So is it the same generation of texts that had to be before you?
There was no text at all. Brown stood up in front of me in the lecture. He just used the Socratic method of asking questions. I was bewildered because I didn't know where they were coming from. No text, no anything. He's just asking questions and giving out problems. And I'm reading desperately every time I go back to get my hands up. Fortunately, the year before I came
back to graduate school, I bought Dodge's Thermodynamics mm-hmm. and self-studied it. And although I couldn't read it all myself, this was a big help. And I had bought Rule Church's books on complex variables and boundary problems and complex variables and on modern operational methods and all. So I had self-studied all those.
That was while you were at Shell and Frontier?
At Frontier, yes. So that helped a little.
Is that Churchill any relation to you, by the way? I meant to ask that.
We decided that we are probably sixth or eighth cousins. Our family came to the United States by exactly the same pathway.
Mm-hmm. So, one other footnote to that. Were other engineers in your in equivalent positions to you in industry at that time doing similar sorts of things? And were people reading on the outside? At Frontier, there must not have been a large library that came up with a problem.
The nearest library was 90 miles away at Lubbock. Say or take something out of it, yes.
So I didn't really use the library. I just brought those books to the bookstore in Michigan. And I had written back and asked what books I might study. And in fact, I wrote to Cass and asked what I basically suggested I study Dodge.
In 48-49, you were a research assistant. 49-50, you became a research assistant. What was the difference of responsibility in that?
Well, this was just sort of a promotion of types of things. J.C. Breyer, who had done work, he was in charge of Southwest Proving Ground during the war, which tested ammunition. And when he came back, he had a contract with the Army Chemical Corps, the Army Ordnance Department, to study the ammunition propellants in which they had in a great deal of trouble. So the research contract. And he offered me a job working on the research mission. I actually developed the doctoral thesis out of some of that work. And so I think he was, he hired three or four other people that were physicists and chemical engineers, and he was pleased with my work, so he promoted me, so I had more money the next year, I guess.
Did you continue doing it when you started to teach?
Yeah.
You were still working on a project.
In 1950, Brown invited me to be an instructor in I made a good impression on several people because Cass later told me that Brown had suggested hiring somebody, and he said, why don't you hire Steve Churchill? I was plunged into teaching. I think the next day I felt really over my head. Breyer was a little unhappy because I was really working full time for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I went half time on that and half time on teaching.
What kind of course load did you have?
The first semester I only taught stoichiometry, two sections. However, I decided I was very unprepared. I did not want that to happen again. So after a week, I went in and asked Brown, what am I going to teach next semester? And he said, well, maybe the unit operations course. So I thought I would sit in on this. So I walked into Katz's class, and so Katz saw me sitting back there. He said, are you back here for learning about teaching? And I said, yes. Well, he said, if I'm away, I will let you take the course. I never saw him again. I took every single course in the class the rest of the semester because he was involved in some big lawsuit out in Western Canada over oil fields, and Slepcevich, who was teaching the other course, found this out, and I ended up taking almost all of his, and I really didn't dare say no because I so desperately wanted to become a member of the faculty, and that was a difficult time.
Well, that'll teach you to come in and sit on
it. That's why he doesn't sit in on the class.
You're working well on your PhD research.
Yes. I joked about working, half-time on the research project, full-time teaching, and half-time on my thesis during that period, and that's sort of what happened.
Well, it sounds like it. What
books were you using to teach out of it? Was it the Haldane Watson?
I taught out of Haldane Watson in the stoichiometry, but in the weird operations, that was the notes that became Brown and Associates. So they were in sort of half-baked
form. Then I taught thermodynamics with Martin, and I think I only used his notes. It was classical in Michigan, which I guess I have always fallen into. Everybody taught something that wasn't in books.
Mm-hmm. So all these people always passed out notes.
So they were always writing a book.
Yeah, it was many of
that. Any of that types of notes.
Yeah, that seems to be coming in many areas. We just got a brief digression. We just got a set of notes for Fred Billmeyer's textbook on polymer chemistry that was passed around in the early 50s before that became a book.
So I used first joint Lightfoot in mold form,
really,
as a test to the test place.
Yeah. And did you, in many cases, when the authors asked for feedback, did you find that they or other authors really did try to revise things based on feedback from people?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I certainly appreciate this when somebody writes me 30, 40 pages of corrections or something, all of which are legitimate. Although, to tell you the truth, Bob Bird never acknowledged that some 50 or so pages of revisions or, corrections that I sent to that. But I may have been just a oversight.
So by now, it's about 1950, 51, 52, you're
working on your thesis, working with Breyer, teaching what sounds to be an onerous load of
introductory courses.
That was probably the worst semester. I tapered off a little bit, but I was always teaching a new course, which I had never had before. Like the thermodynamics I had studied for the qualifying examination, I never had an undergraduate thermodynamics course, so you really had to be a student as well.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in on somebody's lectures and teaching a recitation section.
Yeah. Well, it's a good way to learn, isn't it? What was there a connection between this?
I was also taking graduate courses all this time. At Michigan, then, the students took an incredible load of doctoral level graduate courses, which seems to vanish from all schools.
While you were doing your
yes.
research for your dissertation, that's interesting. Were you taking them grades and you just sitting them?
No, it was great. We had to take courses in depth in at least two other fields, like physics and chemistry and mathematics, and we had to take perhaps beyond the master's degree 10 or 12 courses in chemical engineering.
So what portion of your time were you able to devote to your
dissertation? Not much. Part of it was out of a research project, because a lot of the equipment was sort of simultaneous in this. One just worked longer hours in those days. Things have really changed in that regard. All the graduate students were always around the building right until midnight, here and there.
That was one of the next questions I wanted to ask. Who else were your fellow graduate students at the time?
Well, I know them all today, and there they are, and see them regularly. Matt Gilkison, who's out in Washington with the ASCE, and Bill Berner and Todd Corley, who are both down here at Wilmington, were with me all those years. Jim Knudsen, who is at Oregon State, and Ed Young, who's on the faculty at Michigan, Subcevich, who is at Oklahoma. And if I sat down, I might think of 30 or 40. These people I've stayed fairly close to, because we see each other regularly in professional meetings. That's the first group of people, my fellow graduate students, that I've ever maintained an association with. But it's very active. Just next to my own doctoral students, they're my next rank of friends, perhaps.
So then the atmosphere was different as a graduate student and as an undergraduate. Sense of camaraderie.
A sense of camaraderie was very, very high. We worked together, and we went out together, and we did things together, and it was you knew everybody. And despite those very large numbers of people, this was one big happy family living around at night. And so
did the faculty get in on this as well? I mean, you said earlier that they had.
I knew all the faculty. They were fairly sociable. We went to things together and so forth. Yes, I.
Did they mellow because you were a graduate student?
I'm sorry.
Did they mellow because you were a graduate student?
Yes. There was a great social distinction. They paid very little attention to the undergraduates, or at least to me when I was one. But as a graduate student, you were sort of part of the family. And I think that's true to a large extent. Most places, and in varying degrees to this day, everywhere.
So you mentioned Newton, who in 52, you and he taught a course on heat transfer and fluid flow of cats. Did that emerge out of your research, or was just part of the course was needed on that? You might just say a few words about the relationship between your research at the time.
Cats and Phelps had been teaching that heat transfer course forever. They felt, and when I taught it,
I thought it was very old hat. It was all things I knew from Shell and experience, and was out of date. Knudsen had been doing not his doctoral research, but he had been a sort of a graduate seminar in which he worked with cats and compiled things he and other students did. He was in the process of writing that book, which came very well known for heat transfer and heat transfer by Knudsen cats. He can't decide that Jim and I, who was going to do that heat transfer course for that year, we would each take a third course. And that way we would train the center all that time for the new material. He wanted to put his plan together and put this part of the cats and so well in national training. We would bring in for that. That's what we did. I don't know if I was going to have much relationship to my research or not. I think it mostly came out of self-study. I upgraded the mathematics, but in part, at the same time,
maybe a year later, I took his head to get a heat transfer seminar to this part of Travis. That was perhaps the most profound experience of my life. Myocarditis just opened up a whole new world of theoretical heat transfer. It was sort of self-study. We also had, that was IU 52, we also had graduate students, and we assigned them to all the new technical things that were coming out. Each student was to study that area or that paper and come to report. We were all doing this. It was a great self-education, and this was a honor jump in what we were doing. I won't say it was then the most advanced course in the country, but it made the jump up to work as advanced as any word at the time.
It seems that your paper on fundamental energy transfer was that what I was teaching?
No.
Or was that?
I don't think that's a very significant. It just happened that Faust was supposed to give a lecture at the ASCE meeting. case because he said, I can't go write a Jewish story. And I said, well, he said, I have to figure out why don't you write something. So, you have a sense of educating a child that maybe he could be a little simplification to him. So, he didn't have college, said, let's make up the pattern of college. College is never that basic. There are a bunch of equations in the solution. And seeing the meaning of it,
you were concerned as an educator.
Well, I think so, because I think during that whole period, from 1947 to 52, I was examining what they were doing, thinking how I was going to get them teaching.
Research on propellants is something that you could use the equipment and be permitted to publish.
And the reason for studying this is the problem still exists, you know, projectiles and branded rocket, solid rockets, and things, how do we make them turn? And we were studying the flow of the hot gas that comes from the black powder or something, and that's flowing over something, and the way of heating something up. And I realized there were no data in the literature for heat transfer with large temperature differences. There were data only. Industry uses, and there's 100 degree difference. If you put a 1,000 degree temperature difference, how would you predict the breaking temperature? So that's why I said, we had that hot gas stream to ignite propellant. So I just built a test object to measure the rate of heat transfer, and I don't know, I read the literature and decided it would be nice to measure local heat transfer coefficient, the rate of variation of heat transfer coefficient around the cylinder.
There had been two or three such measurements in the German literature, and one at MIT.
That was looking at it.
Yes.
So this 1955 paper that is on convective heat transfer from a gas stream at high temperature was the work that you carved out of the project of Briarton.
Yeah, there are other papers there that came out of that project too. The emission of propellant, there's a paper that drew the one prior on the emission of propellant. There's a maybe some other one. But it's not considered to have attention to the field of events. I guess the answer to that is yes. And if the work was sponsored and classified, and it was sponsored by the Air Force and the Navy and the Chemical
Work, I mean the Aberdeen Department of Ordnance,
they decided to meet and they were going to drop sponsorship, and the same thing the Navy and Air Force turned up and said we're interested in that work, exactly, we're rockets. And so, of course, then all of a sudden the Ordnance Department decided it wasn't so bad after all. So we had one of the two projects, I suppose, ever sponsored by all three branches of the service.
What?
But I think the problem is still being worked on. You don't see much of the literature because of this classified literature to this day. The Navy in particular still looks at it. Whenever they shoot off a solid rocket or hit, that problem is a critical problem. And many other people, there are indeed, to this day, particularly the Russians, are still publishing articles on this subject. The heating of a solid composed of nitroglycerin, nitrocellulose, this, and what point it will ignite and how fast it will ignite is a very critical problem. Anytime you shoot anything, whether it's a fireworks, or a shotgun, or a howitzer, or a rocket. So, it remains an important problem. I did not, we identified a few things, but I think other people did not. They were important to the process of composition of the gas, how high the temperature was in velocity. In other words, one other student, Charles Thatcher, who also got his PhD there and teaches at Arkansas now, continued the phase of that movement. But I never worked on that problem again. After, I guess, I finished my doctoral research,
when did you get the offer as assistant professor?
I don't remember the formal offer, but I remember their saying that they would make me an assistant professor in the fall. If I got that, I think I had some kind of temporary appointment in the spring. At the time, they were probably making up the back of the list for the fall.
But it sounds though that although you dropped that training research, that the issue of the problem you transferred did overlap with the seminar missions where you were looking at.
Yeah, I'd say that we're relating to that all my life, but. Something else happened that caused me to change abruptly my field of research at that time. And to the state bank, which I was a member of the bank, I had turned in a proposal to the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project. They were looking at assessing the effects of nuclear weapons on the population, and in particular,